So Pat studied that. We then did some work, further work in that area by Joe Gajewski in a different kind of system. We did some work, David Wilner did some work. The Wilner and Warnhoff work was done at USC, and then the Gajewski work, and then some work by Poonian, and by a very large number of other people was continued at Wisconsin during a large part of the time we were there. And the general answer to the question is that there are memory effects. And then the question became, why are there memory effects? Now, our feeling was that these were differences in the structure of the carbocation themselves. Other people wanted to ascribe them to cation effects or solvent effects, you know, differential solvation and so on. We tested that out to the best of our ability by starting with different leaving groups. For example, we observed the same effect, quantitatively, the same effects in deamination that we observed in sulvolysis of arine sulfonates. They're independent of solvent, so we changed solvents. We could start out with starting materials with the leaving groups in different locations so that the instantaneous location of the cation would be different in the two. The results from the two pathways were identical. That is to say, you got memory effects, but they were the same memory effects regardless of where you started out. So our long-range conclusion was this was probably not an example of a cation effect or a solvent effect, that it had to do with the structure of the cations themselves. Now, I have to say that Herb Brown intimidated me during this period, because we wanted to broach the idea that some of this could be due to non-classical binding. Because if you start out from two different precursors, the bonds that are being delocalized in the course of generating the carbocation are different. And so there's going to be some time lag before that cation, the initial cation, organizes itself into the final target cation, or the cation that is destined to become. And one way that non-classical bonding would be one way of preserving that memory. Now, we never use that word, but it's sort of implied in what we wrote. We made a much more general kind of suggestion that it had to do with conformational differences. That is, it's actually the location of atoms, and without specifying what kind of bonding one was looking at. Mm-hmm. So I think...
You think the reason you hedged like that was because of
Herb Brown? Absolutely. Herb Brown was going around the country giving lectures saying that there was no such thing as non-classical bonding, and that people were making too much out of this, and he was shooting people down left and right and citing people from the literature who were invoking non-classical ions, sometimes, admittedly, with insufficient evidence. And we didn't have any evidence that this really was non-classical ions, but this was like throwing a red flag in front of a charging bull, you know. I didn't want to get into that argument. So we soft-pedaled that aspect of it.
Do you think that he had something to do with Saul's early demise? I mean, or just...
Well, a lot of people say that, but I think...
I hear that every so often.
I think that one has to keep in mind the fact that Saul had a long history of heart trouble. And so he was kind of a ticking time bomb. And I don't think people realized how serious it was.
He worked very hard no matter
what. He worked. He was an enormously driven individual. So, you know, but let's put it this way, that those encounters with Herb didn't help.
You said earlier that the years at Wisconsin were enormously productive, and
yeah.
and yet you spent 6 years there. And you
That's
left.
Right.
In fact, I noticed on your resume that part of that time you were in Cologne and part of the time you were in Western Ontario, so you weren't even there for 6 years.
Yeah. Well, the sojourns in Cologne and in Western Ontario were a matter of a few weeks each time, okay. Not for whole semesters or years.
Okay.
So,
I didn't
really leave.
You weren't running away from Wisconsin right from the beginning.
No, I was in contact with the group, and I never left for very long.
Okay. But they were extremely productive. At that point, were people starting to leave? I mean, a group of people went to Stanford, as I remember, or maybe just a few people went to Stanford.
Yeah, I came to Wisconsin just after that.
Oh, they had already gone.
They'd gone. Van Tamelen and Johnson had already left.
Oh.
A number of other people had left to go other places. And Wisconsin, in fact, is one of the key farm clubs for other departments. You could put together a pretty darn good department from people who have left Wisconsin. Yeah, which is probably not exactly what they want to be known for, but it was a powerhouse group. There's no question about it.
So why did you leave? I mean,
why did I leave Wisconsin?
Yeah, I can imagine, that had to be a great lure.
Yeah, I think it was a combination of things. It was mostly personal, selfish things. It was, this was not an obvious step up to come to Yale. The department was in a pretty run-down condition, as I became aware when I became chairman a year after I got here.
Yeah, I was going to say, did they hire you to become chairman?
No, that was not in the deal. They sprung that trap after I got here. But I think it was a location. It was the feeling that Yale was a smaller place and I'd feel more comfortable with it. I didn't really enjoy teaching classes of 300 or 400 people, which I had to do at Wisconsin. I had virtually no interaction with the undergraduate students. It just was not done. It was not expected, and there was something too big about it. There were some other things, I'll say this at the risk of possibly offending some people. There was too big a cleavage between the various branches of chemistry at Wisconsin, probably because of size. But there was a very strong separation into subsections, or whatever you want to call them, sections. So there was an organic section, yeah, and there was a physical section, and a theoretical section, and all of these people, the groups were kind of orthogonal to each other. There was very, very little interaction.
Yeah, you seem to have interacted with people all along the line. I mean, when you did so with Benson, of course, the USC department was small.
Yeah.
And here, you seem to both interact with people within the department and outside.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. It was much easier to do here, I found. And I don't know exactly the reason for that, but there was an insularity about the way the department operated that I didn't like. And I felt it was ultimately going to be a handicap to me, because the deeper I got into this stuff, the more I realized that I didn't know. And I had to have colleagues in areas that I was unfamiliar with who were willing to spend some time with me and just teach me, to lead me, you know. And I found it very difficult to do at Wisconsin. I tried very hard to...
Who did you find here that did that sort of thing? Wes Borden is not... Is he still at Washington?
Yeah, he's still at Washington, yeah. So I bet I sought him out, when he's still at Harvard. And so we made contact there. It was clear that he had a lot to teach me, and so I've depended on him a great deal over the years. But over time, I've interacted with Mike McBride, with Ken Weiberg, with Kurt Zilm in the department here. We did experiments together on the...
Zilm's a physical chemist.
Yes, a low-temperature NMR guy. And he was in our collaboration led to the first NMR spectra of a biradical. So that was very important work for us. That was sometime in the 80s, middle 80s.
There was another paper where you had collaborators in Canada and,
right.
and France, and or was it in France? I noticed here.
Well,
it was one of the papers that you had given me, one of the later papers.
There was a group at the Ottawa laboratory, Tito Scaiano, who we collaborated with on some fast kinetics work. We had several papers with Tito.
Right. Okay. Oh, that was.
That was on the nanosecond time resolved kinetics. Okay. And I tried very hard to, to first of all look into the possibility of setting that up here by ourselves. I was discouraged from doing that because people I talked to, Chris Foote, for example, said it took him 5 years to get his system up and running. Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah.
5 years.
Right. Yeah.
And then we tried to make contact with Nick Turo. That didn't work out because he had the hardware, but it hadn't been used for a number of years, and it had fallen into decay and had been cannibalized.
You did do some work with Nick on that.
That was just spectroscopy,
okay.
Static spectroscopy. But then we finally made this contact with Tito, who had unparalleled capacity to do that stuff mm-hmm. at Ottawa. Scaiano, J.C. Scaiano.
Right, I got that.
That must have been, the first of those papers must have been around middle 80s, 86 or 87, something like that.
I'm sure I'll find that.
I can put my hands on it here.
Here it's 247.
Yes, there was another earlier one, number 220.
Okay.
That one, I think, was the first one, 1988. Number 220. Absolute rates of dimerization and cycloaddition of 3,4-dimethylene furan and 3,4-dimethylene thiophene by nanosecond time resolved spectroscopy. So that was a very important collaboration. And then the work we did on tetramethylene benzene. We had collaborators all over the place. We had, Tito's group. We had Zilm's group here at Yale. That must have been 1993, does that sound right? The full paper was published. And we collaborated on that work with Pierre Vogel's work in Lausanne in Switzerland. Here it is, number 247.
Right. Yes, I did have that.
So there are the whole.
Yeah,
that was the Swiss group that we involved in that. So these people were all sort of coming from different points of the compass, focused on this one problem, and the reason that we did that was that to reproduce all that technology would have been just very time-consuming and probably foolish. I mean,
yeah.
This way, all we do is share the credit.
Yes.
But the science gets done, you know.
As long as you can convince those people to take on a problem.
Well, I think they were really interested in this. That they were really interested.
Because it presents a challenge for them.
Sure, and they had techniques that could be applied, and so it's a kind of a showcase for what they're capable of doing.
The last paper you suggested to me.
which was also a review, but it reviewed a lot of your earlier work about the tunable singlet.
Yes, right.
That's really kind of cute stuff.
That's pretty far out stuff, yeah.
And of course, you suggested where it might go in terms of conductors and anti-conductors.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything about that particular?
Well,
stuff?
Yeah.
Or does it speak for itself?
Well, let's say that this. This was an idea that sort of an offspring of the work on the violations of Hund's rule. And so we began to think that, well, there are other ways that one could have biradicals that had singlet ground states, but that didn't depend upon this lack of spatial overlap of orbitals. The kind of Borden-Davidson consideration, and so what we thought was that if you start out with a typical sort of an idealized biradical, you have the frontier orbitals are degenerate. They have exactly the same energy, and that's what leads to all this confusion about singlets versus triplets. So if you want to get away from that and get into the realm where you begin to favor singlets, you can. Put in some perturbation in which you separate these two orbitals, and eventually you will get to a point where the gap between those two orbitals is larger than the repulsion energy of the two electrons for putting two electrons in one orbital. Mm-hmm. So that's the strategy that we followed, and we did that with these that set of papers that was reviewed there, and we did that by tuning that frontier orbital separation by changing the hetero atom from oxygen to sulfur to nitrogen, and the prediction would be that that one should increase the singlet triplet separation. That's true at the calculational level, but experimentally it's very difficult to prove because you usually don't have both the singlet and triplet in hand as an observable entity. So the final note in that symphony, as it were, was struck by leaving the nitrogen invariant but changing the substituents on the nitrogen. See, the nitrogen is a functional element because you have either NH or some NR, some substituent.
Right.
Now, that substituent allows you to change the electron demand on the nitrogen, and thereby to change the perturbation of the biradical orbitals. So, in the last case, we were able to switch over a series of those pyrrole biradicals, 3,4-dimethylene pyrrole biradicals, from being robust singlets to being robust triplets by changing the nature of the substituent on the nitrogen,
and also by changing the wavelength at which you generated.
That's an experimental ripple, which was a purely serendipitous finding. We did not know that was going to work that way, and at first, in fact, it didn't work that way because when we used the same wavelength of light we had used to generate all the singlet biradicals, we got the singlet form. But when we switched over to a different wavelength, we generated the triplet form. Now, exactly what the reason for that is buried in the mysteries of the excited states of these precursor molecules, and we don't really understand why that is.
How did you? I guess I read how you happened to change wavelengths. I mean, normally you wouldn't.
I was a stubborn graduate student, Linda Bush, who came in, and she had put in years of work making these precursors, very hard molecules to make, at least the first time around. We subsequently discovered a much easier way of doing it, but it's always the case that the first time through was really hell on wheels. But she finally got some of the stuff, and she did this experiment, and she found a molecule that was a singlet molecule. It had no ESR spectrum, and it had all the properties of a singlet. And I said, well, Linda, it looks as though our prediction is not going to hold up. what do we do next? Should we just publish this? And she said, wait a minute, I want to try another wavelength. She said to me, I want to try another wavelength. I said, well, what makes you think that's going to work? Right. Why should that make any difference? She said, I just have a hunch. And she had...
Woman.
So who knows what... She had probably seen something in the literature that gave her the thought that perhaps one could enter an excited state manifold from different point, different spin point, by using different wavelengths of light. And so she went ahead and tried it, and it worked. And I can't tell you that how that was a big lesson for me. Yeah. I was supposed to be her mentor, but if I had had my way, I would have talked her out of trying it.
I remember, Frank Westheimer once said to me, sometimes you just know too much, and you don't do things.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Was the doing the tetramethylene benzene, it had already been done.
Yeah.
And you just redid it because theory and experiment didn't agree?
Right.
And you thought
two reasons.
It's more
complicated than that. You see, we had published a theoretical paper, Paul Lotti and Angelo Rossi and I, in 1995, I believe it was, in which we had applied some rather approximate semi-empirical methods to calculating that molecule. And that had an even bigger preference for the singlet state than tetramethylene ethane did. So it was sort of super disjoint. And there's a good theoretical reason for that, which has to do, I think, just with the fact that it has a larger number of pi electrons, so the correlation energy you recover by this dynamic spin correlation is greater the more of those you have. So that should open up, that should favor the singlet more, and that's apparently what it does, at least according to our calculations. So when Wolfgang wrote, published this paper in which he said that, and by then also Wes Borden had done some calculations which predicted a singlet ground state. Yeah. So he said these predictions are wrong, and the whole idea of these disjoint molecules of violating Hund's rule must be wrong. And this is a triplet molecule, and it agrees with Hund's rule. So we at that point we had egg on our face. We had a calculation in the literature which predicted an apparently wrong result. We were trying to make.
There must be millions of calculations in the literature. I mean,
all too many. This week, this every week.
Somebody once gave me a graph of the calculations for the energy of something or other, and the graph was
just follows very faithfully whatever the experiment is. Well, I mean, I don't mean to be cynical about calculations, but all these calculations are approximate, and particularly in this field, the open shell field, that is not a well-explored area of quantum mechanics, and I believe ultimately we're going to find something better than the way we're doing it now. Because fundamentally, I would say that one cannot predict with confidence which quantum mechanical method is going to give a reliable result in a completely new set of molecules. I mean, it's always been done by calibration, by this comparison with experiment. Mm-hmm. And then you learn and you say, well, experience shows that this calculation is good for this kind of molecule. But if you have something completely new and has never been made before, it's a pig in a poke. So we had been trying to make tetramethylene ethane ourselves, tetramethylene benzene ourselves, and basically the Rote group scooped us. They got there first. But what I did not know or had forgotten about was that sometime prior to that, Pierre Fogel had synthesized but had not yet published an independent synthesis of the Rote precursor. of tetramethylene benzene, which is it's a norbornane with a carbonyl group on the top and then four methylene groups elsewhere. So this was even before the Rote paper appeared, and before I knew that he had done it, but I knew that we were trying to make it and we had failed. We were trying to make it from some other precursor. But he had seen our prediction in the literature that this should have a singlet ground state, and so he just wrote me. He said, I have a sample of this ketone. Would you like to collaborate, and we'll bring you a sample or send you a sample, and you can study the thing spectroscopically using these matrix isolation techniques. So we made that arrangement, and in the course of our doing that work, the preliminary work based upon a very small amount of sample of the precursor that we got from Pierre, it was a very hard compound to make, we got results that led us to think that the molecule did not have an ESR spectrum. And about that time, Rote's paper appeared. So this stimulated us because we were already involved in it when his paper appeared, and we thought we understood what was wrong with his assignment of the structure. And the difficulty was that the carrier of the triplet spectrum that was in the photolysis mixture that he had prepared was not the same molecule as the carrier of the purple color.
Oh, okay.
The purple color was one thing, we felt, and the carrier of the triplet was something else. Okay. So that was the guiding light that guided our work, and we proceeded on that basis. Now, ultimately, what Jim Reynolds, the student who was leading this project, was able to do was to show that you could generate the way Rote had done by photolysis. You could generate both the ESR spectrum and the purple color, but by irradiation at a different wavelength, you could selectively photolyze away the purple color. But in the course of doing that, the triplet spectrum remained unchanged. This was a clear indication that these were two separate things. So the carrier of the triplet, we still don't know what that was that Rote had. Mm-hmm. I mean, we confirmed the fact that it's in there, but it's not the...
I mean, you can get it. Well, obviously you did get it.
Oh, yeah, we can get it eventually. You have to go to low temperature to see it. But it's there, but it's not anything interesting in the context of tetramethylene benzene, because we were able to show by NMR spectroscopy in collaboration with Kurt Zilm that the purple stuff is singlet tetramethylene benzene. So that's absolutely nailed. So that was really the first, if you wish, the first singlet non-Kekulé hydrocarbon. That's the significance of that work. It was not so much that Hund's rule was violated, but that we had demonstrated the correctness of a way of looking at the Hund's rule problem or the spin problem, theoretically, that did lead to correct predictions. And that's the violation of Hund's rule itself. Well, Hund's rule is violated in certain atoms, too. So it's a rule only... Yeah. Approximately. That's not the point. The point is that we now understand under what conditions this type of molecule, biradicals or multiradicals, will violate it and will have low spin ground states, despite the fact that they are open shell.
Come at the end of this tape as well.